you never did before. Here comes a broken heart.
Well, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. That is yet another new Steve Goodman CD just released called Unfinished Business. And I have two young people in here bopping away. I know you guys have never heard Steve Goodman before. I just made two new Steve Goodman fans. Malik Williams and Ashante Johnson are in here with Jennifer Van Valkenburg, the president of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance. The reason you guys are here is you are part of what I think, first of all, I think Garfield Park is Chicago's great, not quite discovered gem. I think it is a sort of secret gem. And you two guys, basically, Malik and Ashante, you guys like run Garfield Park, right? Is that, am I putting it, am I making too much of it?
Yeah.
They're nice kids. The urban, Jennifer, explain the Urban Roots program, and then you two can expound on what you do there. Mm-hmm. They were both featured in a Chicago Tribune article about Garfield Park, the conservatory, and the park itself, and the Urban Roots thing. Urban Roots is now in its fourth year, Jennifer?
Correct.
What is it?
Well, it's a program that works with the Al Raby High School across the street, and we welcome the teenagers from that high school. They come over during the summer, right after their freshman year. We take a bunch of applicants, and they have to go through the whole interview process. It's quite strenuous, and we take about 12 to 16 students every summer, and then they spend about 180 hours with us that summer doing all kinds of things, but mainly they're training to become docents of the conservatory so that they can give tours to visiting groups and visiting students, other young children who think
it's a great program. I don't know which one of you is the oldest, but I'm starting with the prettiest. So Ashante, when did you start in this? When and what was it? I understand from that Tribune article you didn't know much about plants when you applied for this kind of position. Why did you ask to do this?
Well, at the time, like, I needed a job, and I just saw, like, Anne, she came across the street and she gave me, like, applications, so I'm like, why not?
Did you know anything about gardening and plants? Because I'll tell you something. When I grew up and I was your age and you guys are teenagers, I didn't know anything about plants. I didn't know anything about flowers. I didn't know anything about gardening. Did you before you did this?
Not really. I just saw, like, my grandma. She used to plant and garden and stuff in the backyard. So, yeah.
And you would say, wow, grandma's weird. Why is she planting all this stuff in the backyard? What about you, Malik? How long have you done it now? Is this your second year doing this?
Yeah, my second year.
What was it that made, did you know anything about gardening?
I mean, not too much. I just used to, like, my grandma, she was one of those grandmas where it's like, come help me. So it was like she would be in the backyard, like, planting lettuce and stuff. I'm like, what's this? And then she was like, we gonna eat this, and I'm like, what?
What? It's in our garden. It's in our yard. We're not gonna eat this.
There's bugs on it. I didn't know how it worked.
But the interesting thing, I know that you must have been, and you're still with the program, you must have been a little nervous at first, were you?
Yeah.
Both of you were. Yeah. How come?
Yeah.
Because you just didn't, you didn't know the people running it. You didn't know any of that. And how many were there of you? How many, Jennifer? How many were in that the group that Ashante and Malik are in?
This first group, I believe, had 12.
Yeah, 12.
And were they all your friends from the Raby school?
Not all of them.
No,
it was,
yeah.
Like, we built some bonds, like,
yeah,
during the job.
Because we were, like, in different age groups and, like, groups in school. So
yeah.
I was in my junior year and, like, he was in his sophomore year.
Now, do both of you live near Garfield Park?
I do, yeah.
Do you? Do you?
Kind of.
Yeah. Did you know, what did you know of the park? You know, one of the things that strikes me is sometimes in the summer I even drive around and the parks aren't filled with kids the way they were, and I'm old, the way they were when I was a kid, because it's kind of, you know, there's danger out there.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
both know that better than I do, right?
Yeah.
So did you know Garfield Park at all well? You, who live closest, Malik?
No, not really. I moved to the Garfield Park neighborhood about like 4 or 5 years ago, so I ain't really know too much.
Yeah, and you did? Did you go over and play there, or did you have?
No, not really.
Yeah,
like, I was one of those stay in the house. I'm still am like stay in the house, play the game.
Right. Well, that's the nature. And what about you, Ashanti? Did you go in the park? Did you play in the park?
No, I'm like from the Austin community.
Oh, okay.
So I really so didn't.
A little farther west. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't really know about the Garfield Park community.
Jennifer, how did this, Jennifer Van Valkenburg, how did this program start initially? Whose idea was this 4 years ago?
Yeah, it was one of the educators that used to work at the Conservatory Alliance, and it was seeded by IMLS, the Institute of Museum and Library Services,
yeah.
which is a federal-funded program. So they seeded the program for us for 3 years. Play on words, seated. And, yeah, we started off the program, and we went across the street, and we tried to recruit kids, and the kids,
was it literally hard,
across the street.
Was it hard at first?
So hard. We had to recruit kids and just kind of bring them over and go over there a couple of times. We actually partnered with the culinary program at Al Raby.
Okay.
Just to get with the gardening groove and attract kids that way, because Al Raby is a CTE school, a career and technical ed school.
Right, right.
But this year, I'm happy to say, actually, 50% of the rising sophomore class applied for our program.
No
which
way.
Is 33 kids.
Wow.
And
wow.
We were supposed to take 12, and we ended up taking 16.
Was it hard? We got to take a little commercial in a second. You guys are doing great. Was it a hard test? Was it a hard thing to get in, Malik? Did you have to answer like a million questions and,
really,
and pretend you were a really nice kid or something?
No, it's really like they was telling us to really be ourselves. Like, it wasn't really hard. The application wasn't long, very long and hard. And then, like, the interview, it was, like, nice. My interview was with Jen.
Oh,
it
God.
Was my
she's
first
a,
week.
She's a pushover.
Yeah.
She'd be so easy. Now, Ashanti, what about for you? Was it easy or was it kind of intimidating and hard?
Well, it was kind of easy. Well, I didn't have Jen, so I'm not sure.
You had someone harder. All right, we got to take a commercial break. We're going to come back and talk to Malik Williams, Ashanti Johnson, and Jennifer Van Valkenburg about this Urban Roots program at the Garfield Park Conservatory of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance in Garfield Park. You're almost done with the job. You've got to go back to school, but you keep working
during the school year.
It's one of the great programs I've ever heard of. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Welcome back. My new friends, Malik Williams. He will be a junior in the coming school year. My other friend, Ashanti Johnson, will be a senior this year. My other new friend, Jennifer Van Valkenburg, has already been to high school. She's now the president of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance. We're talking about the Urban Roots program, which started, this is now in its fourth year, and which Malik and Ashanti have been part of for 2 years. What has it done for you guys? I mean, you obviously know more about plants than I do, but also, you know, the fact that you people come to the park, and you are the people in charge of showing them what is in that park. How is that for you? Is that fun,
yeah,
Malik?
It's fun. It's real fun. Like, it's really fun to see the smiles on people's face when you see them something new.
Yeah. And are most of the people who come there, many of them have probably never been to Garfield Park before, right?
Yeah.
So you are introducing them to, I think, a real Chicago kind of treasure. Plus, you make a certain amount of money every hour. It's a cool... What did some of your friends think of what you do? Do they think it's cool? Do they think it's nerdy? Do they think... What do they think?
Honestly, like, I got friends on both sides. Like, some of them, some of my friends applied. And it's a few of my friends that actually worked there. And then it's some, like, you went out all day with plants. Like... Like you like an old person or something.
You're like your grandma. Yeah. You're just like your grandma.
But I don't think plants just for like older people. I feel like any age range can learn and know about plants and be excited about them.
Wow, that is, if that is all you learn there, that is a great thing. Ashanti, what about you? Do some of your friends, are they jealous of what you do for the summer, or do they think you're weird like your grandma?
No, most of my friends work with me.
Do they?
Yeah, so I got like maybe three or four friends that worked there with me.
Now, I think you're both a little too young to sort of think, well, maybe I want to devote my life to plants or something.
Yeah, that's what I don't want to do that.
You don't? I don't. Yes, you want to be the president of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance. Jennifer, you must, in the course of this, it's now in its fourth year, you must have seen an astonishing kind of growth.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, when I was your age, I was not... I didn't like to talk to adults.
Right.
I didn't communicate well. You must see these communication skills intensify like crazy.
Yeah, and I can't tell you just sort of the growth I've seen Malik in the last year. I mean, eye contact is just a skill that you kind of have to get used to and practice at
Man.
This age. And these guys are standing in front of groups of children who idolize them, but then also standing in front of adults and giving tours and mostly talking about their favorite plants. And they just do an amazing job. They command an audience now. And
I'll bet.
I don't think they...
Well, they're commanding a radio audience. You can't see all the thousands of people listening to you guys now. I don't want you getting scared about that. But you must, though, in your... You have kind of a set talk that you give about favorite plants. Malik, what's your favorite plant?
My favorite plant in the conservatory is a sensitive plant.
What is that? See, I told you, I don't know anything about this.
It's a plant in the conservatory. It's in our children's garden.
Yeah.
And it's like when you touch it, it closes up, like it folds up on its own.
Wow.
As a defense mechanism. Like in its natural habitat, there's a lot of, you feel me, animals and insects that like to eat plants. So if it folds up and closes up, it looks like it's already eaten. Or dead, so
how
they don't
interesting.
Want
it. What's that called again?
The sensitive plant.
Wow. And how about you, Ashante? What's your favorite? If I came there tomorrow, you're working tomorrow?
No,
okay. If I came there the next day, you're working.
Yeah.
And said, show me your favorite plant, where would you take me?
The banana plant.
A banana plant?
Yes.
Is that a plant that, grows bananas?
Yes.
Is it a plant that, where bananas grow
well,
on the banana?
Well, most people call it the banana tree.
Yeah.
But it's not a tree. It's a grass.
But it still grows bananas?
Yes.
Or no?
Yes.
They know a lot.
Yeah.
What? How long are they kind of tutored before they're kind of on their own?
Yeah, so the first summer is pretty intensive. They're with us 9:30 to 3:30. She's rolling her eyes next to me here for about 180 hours during the summer.
Wow.
Wow. And they learn about plants. They practice communicating to groups. They also have their own garden plot.
Yeah.
So they get to grow their own vegetables. We also do a lot of financial training, right? Because they're getting paid. So we do a lot of work to hopefully establish bank accounts and things like that so we can make sure they're prepared for having pretty much a full-time job all summer.
What do your parents think of this?
My aunties, they excited. Like, I'm moving up. Like,
yeah.
I'm getting a job, making my own money. I'm doing stuff for myself.
Yeah.
You too?
Yeah, my family was, like, really, like, supportive and excited when I got the job. Because, like, now I got my job. Like, you make your own money.
Yeah, you don't have to pay rent. You're too young to pay rent. They're not making you pay rent, are they?
No.
And Ashante likes to say she got promoted because...
Yeah, I work at the front desk as well.
Wow. So you're greeting all the people who come in there all the time.
Yeah.
I got to believe you guys are on for a little while longer, but I've got to believe, do you guys appreciate Garfield Park? It's got to become one of your favorite places on the planet now that you know about it, right?
Yeah.
No, just wait.
Well, you know all the bad stuff. Okay,
no,
we will after some commercials and the news, we will find out the deep, dark secrets of Garfield Park from Malik Williams, Ashante Johnson, and Jennifer Van Valkenburg. Welcome back. I am still here with my new friends, Malik Williams, Ashante Johnson, and Jennifer Van Valkenburg. She has a title. She is the president of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance. But Malik and Ashante are part of the Urban Roots program. You can go to garfieldconservatory.org to get a lot more information about this thing. Now, you guys have to go back to school. pretty soon at the Raby School right across the street from Garfield Park.
Yeah.
But you still are part of the program. How does it change? You're not there being a docent all the time, 5 days a week or whatever crazy hours Jennifer makes you work. What do you do when school starts?
We go over there every other Friday, and we give tours.
You do? You still give the tours?
Yeah.
Both of you?
Yeah. We go different days because we're different. Like,
now they're
age
fighting.
Groups.
Hey, they're not really fighting. They can get along very, very, very well.
Yeah.
Jennifer, you must be so proud of this program. You know, you start something only now in its fourth year.
Mm-hmm.
You seem incredibly pleased.
Yes.
Not only do you hire one of these people,
yeah.
But how was this thing funded?
Yeah, so like I said, we had that seed grant from IMLS, which is great. And then this year, we won a major grant from the Impact Grants, $100,000 grant to keep it going for the next 2 years. And it was really, Ashanti can speak to it. It was kind of a wonderful process where a group came and interviewed us, and they stood up in front of 25 women and spoke the case. But we also have other funders, like Bank of America has signed on this year. So I think, you know, us telling folks about this program will help us extend its life. It costs about $125,000 a year because we're paying all these kids.
Well, the other thing is,
summertime.
You should.
Yeah,
there are
absolutely.
Too many, no, in this world, there are
wage.
Too many unpaid internships
yeah,
and the
absolutely.
Whole nonsense. Like, you're going to learn so much that we don't have to pay you. It gives you guys, doesn't it, Ashanti and Malik, a sense of what it's like to work, what it's like to be out and about, what it's kind of like to be grown-ups, right?
Yeah.
It's no good, I'll tell you that right now.
Nope.
It's not.
No, it's 5 days a week, intensive, 9:30 to 3:30 for 6 weeks over the summer. So
and it's taught
intense.
You, must have taught you some kind of, you know, like responsibility, right? I mean,
yeah.
You're not fooling around all the time, and that life can be, that you can earn from doing something fun. The senator, Dick Durbin, was there on Monday. What was that like? Were you intimidated by him, or did you show him that banana plant?
Yes.
You did? What did he think? Did he go, wow, did they grow bananas here? What did he think?
Well, yeah.
Was he nice?
Yeah, he was really nice.
He was funny.
He was funny?
Yeah, he was funny.
Was he, like, making plant jokes, or what was he doing?
It was like a mix. Like, it was like any situation or anything we were talking about, it was a joke. It was funny. It was fun.
Yeah.
Now, has this given you guys, I know you're still young, and you maybe go to college, or maybe, you know, go into the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Has it changed you? I think it probably has in important ways.
Yeah. Like responsibility wise, like you can't be playing all the time.
So sort of like that switch, like you gotta switch on and off when you're in like a workplace versus when you're outside playing with your friends.
Right.
So you gotta really change, and you gotta, you know, okay, I'm at work, I can't do this, what I normally do.
Yeah, I mean, it's giving you a sense of responsibility.
Yeah, and most definitely the technology part.
Yes.
You got to put your phones up, you at work. Mm-hmm. And, like, now I feel
it's
like a lot
an
of...
urge.
Yeah, it's like, because these days, a lot of, like, teens and kids are attracted to social media.
Oh,
and, like,
tell me about
technology.
It.
So that's really a big part, like the phones.
Well, but isn't it fun? I'm not trying to change you here, but isn't it fun to get away from technology for a while?
We're doing like games and activities. Like, we learned a lot of fun games over this summer and last summer.
Yeah.
Like, you put the phone down, you really can engage in one activity and see how much fun it is.
Yeah, and like just bonding with people, close to your age and stuff.
Well, and being in touch with like the real world, with things that are alive and real, as opposed to something that's a photo on your stupid phone. Not your stupid phone. I think all phones are stupid. Jennifer, you have to be very proud of certainly these two kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they just, you know, having them at the conservatory just brings it to life, you know? I mean, just seeing them all summer engaged in their gardening outside, giving the tours, all the things that they do. They're there every day, and it just brings such life and energy to the conservatory. We love our guests as well. We have a lot of guests
Come
every year.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, they're obviously treated well by these two. Yeah. You know, look, I learned about a banana plant. I still have not to see one. Yeah. I'm going to have to come out for a special banana plant tour one day.
The whole tour.
Huh? You give me the whole tour? How long does a tour take? I mean, when you say a whole tour, Malik.
It's really depending on the group size.
Right.
The group like how much they want to see.
Yeah.
What
we normally do like 30 minutes, 30 to 45
really?
Minutes. Yeah, depending on like.
They can do a lot of plants.
Wow. Depending on if you have like questions.
How
long.
That's great. Who has more questions, little kids or old people like me?
I say
elders.
Older.
And I love giving to
They're like, what's that? I had the banana plant.
I like younger kids only because, like, they like when you show them something they never heard or know about, it's like they face. That's when the questions start.
Well, I actually like giving toys to elders. It's just like whatever you do or talk about, they will love.
So, that's right. Oh, you got me. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so like I was giving a tour. I was giving a tour to these elders.
Yeah.
And they just loved everything. They was like asking questions. And she was like, oh, I just like this. And she even gave me and this other girl I was working with a dollar.
Well, see, I'm old, but I'm a much better tipper. Malik Williams and Ashante Johnson is not my place to be proud of you, but man, you are good for Garfield Park.
Thank you, Jennifer
Van Valkenburg, who is the president of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance. You can bring these guys on anytime.
Thank you.
You know, one of these days, you two are probably going to run this station one day.
I hope so.
You want to?
Want to. Yeah.
Okay. Well, remember Rick. Remember me. Remember who put you on and gave you your first chance at radio. You guys are great. You guys are great.
They can do anything.
Get
so
home
don't
safe,
put it past
all of
them.
You. Yeah. We'll be back in a couple minutes and talk novel writing.
Dutchman's not the kind of man who keeps his thumb jammed in the dam and holds his dreams in. That's a secret only Margaret knows. When Amsterdam.
That, of course, is the voice of the one and only Steve Goodman. He still has another CD of much unreleased stuff. It's called Unfinished Business. My next guest, Syed Haider, and I have about 550 mutual friends, don't we?
Yeah, so it seems. Maybe more.
But I am. It is such a pleasure to meet you, and it was such a pleasure to read your second novel, The Life of Ganesh. We will talk about that at length. But I need to know, you're also the founder and senior editor of Chicago Quarterly Review. The fiction editor of Chicago Quarterly Review is our mutual friend, John Blades.
Yes.
What does Gary Houston do for the Quarterly Review?
A lot. He... I'll give you the details. Yeah. Don't worry about it. He solicits ads. He brings name brand people from Chicago area that he know from his both theater world and the Sun Time world.
Yeah.
And so he is really helping us a lot. We are an independent publishing people. And
take me back, Syed, before you founded this esteemed literary magazine, and it's such a weird thing to even start a literary magazine, even in the mid-90s, because very few people were doing it. You maybe had the Paris Review and some others. Why did you decide to found the Chicago Quarterly Review?
Out of desperation. We were all writers. We were all sort of mature people who have done other things, psychologists, doctors, lawyers, and at some point decided that, oh, we should be a writer somehow.
Well, I know that you had, you kept a journal when you were a young man.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, somewhere along in the course of your life, you decided, I'm going to read some stuff. There's one incredible lovemaking scene at the beginning. It's on page 13 of the Life of Ganesh, and I'd love to read it, but the WJN listeners would fall out of their beds.
Is it okay?
No, it's not. Yeah, it's okay to read.
Yeah, exactly.
You decided to become a writer. Why?
It was hard to see how to be a writer. And then I was reading John Fowles a lot. And
John Fowles, probably most famous for the French Lieutenant's Woman, I would think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Magus and others, but yeah.
See, and the funny thing about writers, they can become most famous when someone makes a movie out of one of their books. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you know somebody who wants to read?
Yeah. Well, Life of Ganesh. It travels back and forth in time. It's a love story. It's a rumination about life and I think the meaning of life. But back to you. You decide you're going to be a writer.
Yeah, and John Fowles believed, or at least so he said, that writing comes from the lost domain, something that's gone. And in my life, you know, I moved from country to country, changed from job to job. I came to study science and engineering, decided to go to psychology, social work, then still not feel complete and lost. So I thought maybe I should try to do something else, and then having read the master saying, oh, you can write as long as you have some lost domain, something that you're still seeking, something that you're searching for,
right?
Something that's gone. And I have my share of losses, so it
yeah,
was
you
very...
Write that, you write that in the... I find the introduction to this book, to this novel... you also write in here, Syed, the writer's heart is a cheating heart, and you expound on that a bit. Would you expound on that a bit for me?
Yeah, I think, you know, everything you're looking at or hearing, we're making an observation. We want to see how we can make something out of it.
Yeah.
And I carry this notebook. Of course, you know, we are talking on the radio, but so I'm...
It's okay, I see it. Wait, you're talking to me.
Yeah.
You're talking to me.
So, and
do you... you also write about other writers that you write... that a writer falls in love with all good writing, his writing, her writing, writing in any language, and he tests his love for them. He could, if he would, rob them... cheat on them. John Fowles is a huge influence on you, and ergo a couple of people who were influential on him, Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus.
Yeah.
You don't model your work on his, do you?
Oh, I could not.
Yeah.
Fowles was, you know, the command of the language he had, and he could write paragraphs without taking a breath, or when I'm reading, just go into, you know, any of his work. And he's somebody who wrote Magus 1, then went back and re-edited it again. That man was, you know, one of a kind, and his writing is amazing. Daniel Martin, what he did there.
Sure. I think your writing's amazing. Can I read a paragraph from your book? There are a million I could have chosen, but I really like this one. But first, the book is about a man. It travels through time. It is about a man named Ved and his wife and a couple wives and living in a vacation in France. It takes place on three different continents.
Yes.
Through about 30 years of time, more or less.
Yeah.
Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, in Skokie, Illinois. When Ved first came to America, it felt like everyone smiled at him. This is so telling. I'm not certainly a foreign-born and coming here, but this is really astute. When Ved first came to America, it felt like everyone smiled at him and said hello. He used to think Americans were admirably straightforward, friendly, and uncomplicated. He was refreshingly naive and often interpreted the smile of a young woman to be a come-on. "She likes me," he'd innocently think each time. He remembered going to Murphy's department store a couple of times because he took it literally when the pretty young saleswoman told him to come back soon. But when he dutifully returned, she didn't remember him. That captures something. Ved is pretty much of a kind of sensualist, is he not?
Yeah, but he was also off the board then.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say that. The back of the book contains... Now, another friend of yours, obviously, is Peter Ferry.
Yes, he is.
He is a friend of mine, too.
Why?
Peter Ferry is a terribly talented writer.
He is.
Travel Writing is a great novel. Do you know?
Yeah,
how do you know
yeah.
Peter?
Well, he just happened to walk into my house, which I didn't know there was a book party going on, and he somehow crashed the party. I don't know
how. He crashed the party and had a drink. And
yeah.
So he says about Syed's Haider's new novel, his second novel, Life of Ganesh. He says, "The Life of Ganesh is a remarkable novel that spans eras, continents, and cultures, and is full of insight into the human condition and the wisdom and sorrow that comes from being truly alive. Haider's prose often turns to poetry and always hits me right in the heart. He writes with striking emotional candor about things that many of us cannot admit even to ourselves, especially that love is counterintuitive and grows ever more and never less complicated as we want and expect it to." When he wrote that for you, you must have fallen off your chair.
He is a friend, and often I wonder if these people really meant what they're saying.
What do you mean if they meant what they're saying?
I mean, look at it.
It is a very, very fine. You know this. How difficult is it? What is your process? Do you write every day? I feel like I'm doing one of those famous Paris Review interviews. Do you use
please.
A pen? Do you use a computer?
I'm flattered. Yeah, please.
Do you use a pen? Do you use a computer? Do you write every day?
I used to, and I still do, but now I'm struggling with my third book, which was my first book, and my agent at the time said that, "Oh, Syed, you don't have the ending to it." And I tried to patch an ending and send it back to her, and she said, "It's still not working." And then I put it away, wrote my second novel, which became my first novel, To Be With Her, and she liked it. And anyway, and then came the third novel. Now I feel I should finish my first novel, because I think with time and age, I don't know if the wisdom is there or not, but I think I know
you're ready for it.
Yeah, I think I can find an end.
You lost the first draft of this novel, didn't you?
God.
I don't know where I read that. It may be in the introduction.
I think in the introduction.
It's like Hemingway losing his wife that terrible his novel on a train. Was that heartbreaking for you?
Beyond that, it was... Want you to commit suicide.
Yeah, well, okay.
No, but I did not, obviously.
Well, obviously, and you finished the book. In some ways, that kind of heartbreaking occurrence might have found its way into these pages. Do you not think?
It became another lost domain, Fowl said, and I thought, what happened? There was a hard, handwritten, I write by hand even to this day. And
wow.
And that's how the book got lost. I finished it, and it was kind of idiotic on my part to give somebody who was going to word process it. She went to the Kinko's. That was the old days where you go
yeah,
to make copies.
I remember.
Yeah. And she walked out. She said, for whatever reason, my sense is that she probably went to smoke a cigarette or maybe a joint, but we don't know.
Yes, either legally, but so what?
Yeah. And then when she came back, the manuscript was gone.
Well, you know, it's a good thing someone didn't steal it and try to get it published. And then you just would have had to change the title of this book. We have to get some commercials in and then news, but we will continue talking with Syed Haider about his second novel, Life of Ganesh. We'll talk about the first one, too. I want to talk about that and a little more about the Chicago Quarterly Review. We'll be back in a while. Steve Goodman's new album, Unfinished Business. I have some more time left with Syed Haider, the author most recently of Life of Ganesh. I know he's working on a new novel. I know he has written one novel before. He also is the founder and senior editor of the Chicago Quarterly Review, where two of my great former colleagues and dear friends, John Blades works there. He's the fiction editor, and Gary Houston is the managing editor. And The Life of Ganesh is about, it's love, it's family tradition, it's loss, it's east, west. It goes back and forth through time from France to India to Skokie, of all places.
Yes.
The man at the center of this book is Ved. He's a sort of do-it-yourself philosopher, is he not? And he is always thinking about the meaning, don't you think?
Yeah, he is
always contemplating the meaning of life and its vicissitudes.
He starts with that. He in the first chapter when he's standing by the rented house doorway, and he's contemplating where he has arrived and where.
When you write, I know the first draft of this novel was misplaced by some marijuana smoking assistant of yours at a Kinko's or whatever place they used to use. Does the narrative? I know you go into writing a novel with certain. Sort of, you're predisposed to sort of know where the story goes, but the story goes in other directions for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's classical when the people say that, oh, well, you don't know where the story would take, the writing would take it. It really did that to me. I sort of have what I was going to do with the book. Losing the manuscript didn't hurt. I mean, it hurt a lot when it happened, and I have forgiven the person who did that. But what really helped is to writing, is rewriting, layering, relayering. I already know the story that I've written already. I also have my travel journal that kept me all, you know, there are a lot of details about this way of traveling with his family. So all that information was all there. I did not lose that.
I have a notion that a vacation you took to France, just a vacation that you took with your own family, is one of the things that sort of set off this novel. Is that true?
That is exactly what happened. And there was an American woman I met, but there was rest. Everything else is fiction. People often ask, so what happened with her? And nothing.
It wasn't me. This is fiction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, sometimes that's one of the problems with being a novelist, Syed, is that people assume that it's autobiographical,
yeah.
And it is not.
Definitely.
I mean, it is your, you know, philosophy. It is your characters. Tell me about, and I have ordered it already, but tell me about, because I like this, Life of Ganesh, so much, as did Peter Ferry. What's your first novel?
It's To Be With Her, which is in some ways beginning of man searching for to be this love, and it sort of turned into love loss in this second novel, not intentionally, but that's the book developed. So that was much, as a matter of fact, that was probably more autobiographical because
Well, because my first novel. First novels tend to be often more autobiographical. Do you write in longhand?
Yes.
Did you say?
Yeah, I never learned to type. I came to study physics and math and electrical engineering, and you didn't need to have somebody who would do your reports and type it correct, especially in those days. I don't know how good my English is now, but in those days, it was, I did not have the command, so I will find somebody to do the word processing or typing for me, my reports, and they will clean it up so well that I will get good grades.
Which prompts a question, do you write in English?
Yes.
Is that difficult? Joseph Conrad did it in a different language, but is it difficult for you?
Not anymore.
Yeah. Was it?
It was initially. Once upon a time, even in my conversation, I will think in Urdu and translate as I speak. But now it's natural. I'm talking to you in the language I'm thinking.
Well, okay, I'm going to tell you, people, The Life of Ganesh is a book that you should buy. Was it difficult? And you know this quite well, I think, because you're also the senior editor of the Chicago Quarterly Review, which is a literary magazine, which is a tough thing to be in the year 2019. But they're coming out with its 25th anniversary edition soon. Managing editor Gary Houston, fiction editor my friend John Blades. Syed, was it tough to get this book published? The publishing business in the last, let's say, 25 years has become chaos.
Totally. It was very difficult. It still is. I have a very name brand agent, and what she always said when she said, you write very well, but the publishing business is hard. I don't know what I can do for you.
Yeah.
And so far, 2 out of 2, she was not able to sell my book.
Wow.
So I have to find a small independent press.
Now, in many ways, though, what the Chicago Quarterly Review does is nurture young, not always young, but new literary voices. Do you find that that's part of the mission of CQR?
It is. It was a mission.
When you started.
I started it. And now, fortunately or unfortunately, it has become a little too established to be. We are getting such, name brand people send us, and it's hard to reject their work. Well, we still find the best writing.
That also tells you about the market. I mean, they're probably, I'm not going to make a weird guess, but 25 years ago, there were probably another dozen literary magazines out there that no longer exist. How, not just you being the senior editor and John Blades being the fiction editor and Gary Houston being the managing editor, what has allowed you to survive?
Independence operation. We initially put our own money to publish the magazine. And as you were asking earlier about Gary's role, since he has taken the command, he generates a lot of ads for the magazine.
That's correct.
And it is beginning to bring enough money in. And then we still supplement, but being independent of on our own, having nobody to, it gives us a lot of freedom to work.
You can learn more about Syed Haider and the Chicago Quarterly Review by going to chicagoquarterlyreview.com. You do not have your own website, do you?
No.
See, that's one of the, I don't either, but I mean, that's what a lot of authors, Dan will tell you, the most authors who come in here, it's like they have 5 different websites to help sell their book. It is a great pleasure to finally meet you.
I must tell you,
it's a great pleasure to finally read you, too.
Thank you.
The book is Life of Ganesh, that is spelled G-A-N. ESH. Even my old friend Christine Sneed writes of it that Syed has given his readers a sensual and lyrical meditation on love, family, loss, and desire. This is a beautiful, sexy novel by a wise and gifted writer. Christine Sneed is a beautiful, sexy writer,
oh, God,
too.
Isn't she?
Yes, yes, she is. On that note, we'll take a little break and we'll carry on. Saeed, pleasure to know you.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back. Tom Weinberg thought his bag was going to be stolen, so his love of his life, Eleanor Bingham Miller, went to get it for him. This is going to be an interesting 40 minutes because I have in here Tom Weinberg, the legendary videographer, and Bob Chirito, who is among the best reporters that I have ever known. What do you think about that, Bob?
What are you drinking tonight?
Bob has been, you can read him in many, many places, but he has been, in his energetic way over the last few months, been covering what I think, and that I think Tom will think too, is we always think of, you know, things like PTSD and mental troubles as things that affect soldiers, and occasionally might affect people covering, as reporters, war zones. Mm-hmm. What Bob has discovered, I think, or sort of written about, he didn't discover it, because I think the people on the front lines really discovered it, is that there is urban warfare going on here, and it is causing serious problems, is it not, Bob?
Yeah, for a lot of people. Obviously, you know, firefighters and police.
Well, you look at the suicide rate of cops.
Yeah.
One thing.
But, you know, crime reporters have been covering, they're often, you know, right at the scene at the same time, or sometimes even before the police. And for them, I think over time it can be really dangerous if they don't take care of themselves and maybe take some steps and recognize what's going on in their lives.
Do you think part of the problem is in the old days, Tom, get in on this at any time. We're going to talk about something Tom's doing with his Media Burn archive.
My mind went to Joe Cummings. You remember Joe Cummings?
Yeah.
I made a TV show with him and about him.
The Overnight Man?
Yeah,
That's great.
And I learned a lot about exactly what you're talking about, which is it made him crazy.
Yeah.
He might have had a head start. But
well, sometimes just to get in this business, well,
Joe had a colorful life, so
yeah, he should. Yeah.
But the reason this sort of popped up, and I know you've been following it intensely for some time, is Marcella Raymond on the Channel 9 reporter did a Facebook post. You wrote about that on the Chicago Ambassador. What did she post?
Well, basically, that she was diagnosed for actually the second time in her career with PTSD. And I reached out to her a day or two after that post and interviewed her. And that's what started the whole thing with my story.
Sure. Sure. What did you find? It was a kind of media sensation, but I think it was a media sensation because people were like, oh, wait, I see her on TV every day. Nothing could be wrong with her.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, people, for broadcast reporters, people view them in some kind of fantasy, like everything's glamorous. But, you know, she's a regular reporter, just like all the print people, and covering day-to-day, you know, all kinds of things.
Do you think one of the problems in this whole, and I do think it's kind of a burgeoning problem, is that a lot of editors, you know, in the old days in this business, a lot of, as Tom knows too, a lot of people who became editors and who became bosses had been reporters, and they came up that way, so they sort of were aware of the dangers and troubles that existed on the street level, and I don't think that's so true anymore. Bob, what do you think about that?
I think that's a good point. Yeah. I think there's a few things. I think there's some of that. Well, I did it. You can handle it.
Right.
And the
right.
other thing is nowadays the staffs are cut so much, so thin that you're covering more of it. So if you covered, you know, a mass shooting once or twice a year, maybe now you have to do them all because there's nobody else to do them.
Yeah.
And it's not just a mass shooting. It's just day to day. Murders in Chicago here and any
That's
other
the first
city.
First thing I was thinking of when you said that it's a war.
Yeah.
We don't directly see it very often, but there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people within 5 miles of where we're sitting who are scared to death to go out of their house.
They're in a war zone.
Because of the war, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, one thing Marcella said, and I think should be noted, that those people who are unfortunate to live in those neighborhoods have it tougher than any reporters in Chicago.
Oh no, you absolutely make that point in your pieces. The piece that was published today in Gateway. Talk about talk about Gateway for a second.
Well, Gateway Journalism Review is a Midwest focused journalism publication, magazine, and online as well. And it's the editor is Jackie Spinner, who's a Columbia College professor. She's a former Baghdad bureau chief of the Washington Post.
So she, more than almost anybody who might assign this story, gets it, right, Bob?
Oh, yeah. She covered the wars. She was attempted kidnapped. So she knows, you know, she has a lot more danger experience than most.
Yeah. In that piece. You can read his piece at gatewayjr.org. You'll find his piece. And in there you write, Bob Chirito, for decades, groups like the Committee to Protect Journalists have offered safety classes to journalists. But until the last few years, those classes focused on physical safety while covering war and conflict overseas. Since around 2016, more and more attention has been focused on dealing with mental hazards of domestic coverage as well as digital security. We got to take a commercial break, then we got to get some news. We don't. Dan Long says we can carry on here. Then we're going to talk about what Tom Weinberg's up to. Tom, you know you understand exactly what Bob's talking about.
I mean, I would even say that the film that we're talking about addresses a whole lot of the questions of what you were talking about in terms of the people think of the people on TV in a certain way because they are on TV. They don't think of them as reporters like a real reporter.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I'll say, too, they don't think of people on TV, I don't think, as actual real human beings in the same way they don't think of people who are in the background in a murder scene as real human beings either, because they'd never met them. Mm. They're on TV. There is something weird there. I think.
Well, hello.
You know more about.
Who's the president, Rick?
Pardon me?
Who's the president?
You're asking me who the president is?
Yeah.
I don't like to speak the name.
I know.
I know who the president
occupant.
Is. Yes, okay.
And where was he before?
Exactly. No, that's a really, really, really good point. But I think this is, and what you bring up, Bob, in this thing is, yes, it's a, you know, it's such a, the ripple effect of violence is nobody, I don't think, is paying enough attention to it. Do you?
No, and I think it's something that especially editors now are finally becoming a little bit more aware of. I have to say, though, I hope it doesn't change. I think this stuff still needs to be covered. I hope it doesn't change news covers. I just think steps have to be taken so people aren't in danger. And by danger, I'm talking about mental danger more than physical. And you talked about the safety courses. One of the outlets I write for is Reuters, and they made me take a course maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and there was nothing about it was all about war zones and covering riots and keeping yourself safe and that, but there was nothing about
the
mental
the trauma
or mental
and it's not
hazards.
All yeah it's not all PTSD. I think that's a phrase that has got,
well, it's to have PTSD you have to be diagnosed with it,
right.
But there's depression, there's, you know, you know all the guys and women who used to go to the Billy Goat and drink all night, and maybe some of that was self-medication.
No question, because you know cops do that, and you know firemen do that, and the suicide rates for both are up. We now have to take a break for the news, but we'll carry on with this conversation. And, Tom, you can talk about ghosts and the machine.
Okay.
Because Bob and I are both smart, and we'll ask you questions, and we'll grill you. We'll grill you. I do mean that, Bob. You are among the most energetic reporters in this town.
That's right.
But he gets like embarrassed by that.
No,
you really are. Well. Take a compliment.
Thanks.
Like that Mr. Rick Cogan. Thank you, Roger. I'm sitting here with two people I admire tremendously. Bob Chirito, who is proficient and energetic a reporter as I know in this town. He's recently been covering, well, here is the headline of his recent piece at gatewayjr.org, Mental Hazards of Reporting, Not Just a Danger for War Correspondents. He talks about how this affects, you know, the people who cover the war zone that is the city of Chicago. Tom Weinberg runs the great, great organization. I'm not just calling it a website. Organization called MediaBurn.org. And they are having a special screening of a film called Ghosts in the Machine, which, to your mind and out of your mouth, questions our ability to tell fact from fiction in media. That certainly is a huge issue. What is this film, Tom?
It's about an hour long, four 15-minute sections, two by Russian video filmmakers from St. Petersburg, two by American. They each started out with five or six different pieces from the archive, documentaries.
From Media Burn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here it is, Make Your Film. Mm. So they're each film is 100% different, even though the context of the content of the archival piece of the, you know, the old stuff, the documentary piece, is still there, but they treat it completely differently. And the point is, you can't tell.
Wow!
Wow! Yeah, wow is right. Wow is right. You've obviously seen this thing. What do you think?
Oh well, I mean. We did it. I mean, this was Sarah Chapman, the executive director of Media Burn, went to Russia with two Americans and brought the two Russians back here this week. And when I first saw it, I didn't have anything to do directly with cutting it or making it. When I first saw it, it just totally blew me away for a number of reasons. One is that it's a very dense and interesting and visually remarkable. But more for me personally, it was that a whole lot of the things that I produced and worked on and put in the archive are put in an entirely new context decades later. And so, does that make sense?
Yes, but what does it show you? That it is incredibly easy to manipulate?
Well, that's a part of it, but part of it is it's hard to know. Well, you write a story or it's going to be there the way it is forever, the way you wrote it.
Right.
You make a film, a documentary film, let's say it's an hour, and you've got 40 hours of video. So you had to make the choices. As Studs used to say, I'm a gold prospector.
Yeah, right, know? Right.
That's what video editing is. So the context of now versus what it was 30 years ago when you made it is completely different. And now you take these young people making the film, and they don't know the context from before or why it was there.
That's scary. It's like some revisionist, you know, stuff you can do with any subject, really, and just totally change it because the context doesn't fit. Or you're the young reporter's not aware of the context back in the 40s or the 50s or whenever.
Right.
Well, and change it to your, you know, manipulate it to your own personal point of view,
yeah,
too.
Which your
is,
own...
that's the thing that is really...
Agenda.
Yeah, which is really scary to me.
Well, the technology now is this deep fake news. Is that what it's called? Anyway, where they really can change the images and put somebody different in there, which is like, is a completely different layer and level of being able to fake it, to put things in there that don't fit in context. And that happens every night. I mean, even on Colbert, they do it, put words in the mouth of the occupant, you know. And
yeah, but that's, everyone knows it's a comedy show, but in the wrong hands, it could be really scary, it sounds like.
No question. But I think also what you're getting at is, I mean, it's something so 1984-ish.
Yeah, yeah. Not like a Minority Report or something.
Yeah. Well, okay, the film it is being screened on August 24th, which is when?
Next Saturday night.
Next Saturday night at the Film Row Cinema, which is at 1104 South Wabash. You can go to the city diner and have a nice corned beef sandwich before or after the film. It's being screened from 6 to 8. It is only $8.
I think it's free. The $8 is Thursday night
at Uncommon Ground in Edgewater for $8. It's free down here. What do you think people are going to come out of this movie thinking? Do you think they're going to be... Bob Sherita and I are sitting here going, oh my God, we're both like paranoid.
Yeah, we're a little freaked out.
We're freaked out. And
this is more art than it is journalism.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's impressionistic vision of images kind of glommed together with what the kids call mashups, right? So it's not that you would be scared by it, it's that you would be amazed at how different it could be from what your perception of something is,
and also,
but that's not fooling you or saying this guy's this or this, you know. Uh-huh.
But it's the changing, it's the altering of the narrative, right? That
absolutely.
Yeah, that's scary.
Well, who's to say?
What's to say what the narrative
ought to be? You can say for you, I can say for me.
Well, you sound
Bob
like
can say for him.
You sound like Kellyanne Conway when you say who's to say.
I'm not saying alternative facts.
Yeah.
No, truth.
He's the last guy to sound like Kellyanne Conway, believe me. Don't you think, I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to explore as a videographer what Bob's talking about in this new kind of this urban warfare that is taking place here, to chronicle that. Bob, you write for a number of different outlets, do you not?
Yes.
That's the life of a freelance writer, reporter.
Yeah, you have to hustle.
You have covered a lot of crime and disaster in your time. How's it affected you?
Well, I think I've been okay. I have one advantage, I think, than a beat reporter who's constantly covering, and I did that for a while, where it was homicides night after night. But now I get to mix it up, so if I have a lot of serious stories, then I can do a feature on some artist or whatever. But, you know, I think I just try to keep things in perspective and kind of stay detached in a way. As far as the gang shootings, this might sound bad, but my attitude was that these guys kind of sign up for it. So I was never, too broken up over it. Although, you know, there's been a lot of kids over the years and things that always stick in your mind.
Well, there's a lot of collateral damage, sure. Mentally and physically.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, gallows humor.
Well, sure.
I mean, it sounds bad, but that helps.
Well, that's as old as reporting is the gallows humor involved and the drinking at the Billy Goat after this time. You've been in this business a long time, covering a variety of things. Does the violence in this town alarm you? Does it seem vastly different? You know, you and I are from a time when gangs were relatively well organized.
Allegedly.
And they were relatively, well, and ghettoized. I mean, they were not spread throughout block to block to block as they are now.
It's very tricky. Somebody comes, I go to somewhere, some city, and they say, Chicago, oh, they're shooting everybody in the street there.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
just like they used to say, Al Capone.
Yeah. Right.
But the fact is that I can explain to them a couple things. One is that the rate in Baltimore or St. Louis Newark or wherever is higher per capita. Doesn't mean it's good. And you can also explain that the white skin privilege and place we live and the everyday encounters we have doesn't put us in the face of that at all. I mean, directly in the face. Oh, it's on Channel 9 News. Okay. But
I think Lilia, in my story, touched
Lilia
on...
Chacon, yeah, Lilia formerly Chacon, of yeah. Fox.
Touched on the importance, and she covered the worst of the worst, as she says, for years, and she was okay, and she journaled, she had a lot of hobbies, she loves nature, so she had a lot of outlets, and I think that's important, to have healthy outlets, whatever they may be.
Yeah.
Instead of going to the bar and drinking all night.
Right. But then you think of, and again, I hate to beat this up, and then you think of the people who live in these neighborhoods
yeah,
who have nothing. That little boy who was from Garfield Park, I said, you know, well, he lives very close to Garfield Park and had never been there until getting this job. And he said, well, no, because we would stay on nice days, we'd stay inside and play games. And you uh-huh. sense that, and uh-huh. all it takes, and I've done it, is, and Bob, I'm sure you have too, is drive around Chicago on a Sunday. You don't see kids playing baseball.
Yeah.
You don't see people in the parks because of the inherent danger of the drive-by. We got to take a commercial break. We'll come back and try to solve all the problems of Chicago after this. I have until 11 o'clock with Bob Chirito, the talented reporter who you can read. One of his latest pieces was posted, I think, today or yesterday at gatewayjr.org. The headline, Mental Health Hazards of Reporting, Not Just a Danger for War Correspondents. They're a danger for, well, they're a danger for everybody, but particularly he talks to the people who cover crime in the city. You can also see this sounds, and Bob and I both think this sounds like an amazing movie yeah, called Ghosts in the Machine. It is how the highlight reel of culture and history that done by two Russians, two Americans, based on material they've gotten from MediaBurn.org, and how it redefines, changes the narrative of what's real and what's not and what's true and what's false. It will be at Uncommon Ground in Edgewater on August 22nd. I think that's a Thursday. It costs $8. Or you can see it for free next Saturday night, 6 o'clock at Film Row Cinema, 1104 South Wabash Avenue. And go to MediaBurn.org to, and Bob can attest to this, Bob Chirito can attest to this. You go to MediaBurn.org, you will get lost at MediaBurn.org. There's some, wow, 85 videos of Studs Terkel. Yeah. There's the one of the greats is when Studs is talking about his favorite word in Italian. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, you chronicle.
We're talking to the waiter at,
yeah,
at
Bobby.
Ricardo's.
Yeah,
Bobby. Roberto. I call him Bobby.
One of the things that Bob brought up or talking is that we're talking a lot about bad things. It is not. We live in a world where good and evil have ever coexisted.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important in my own reporting and for others who are reporting to remember, and I'm sure they're aware of it. Maybe they just forget at times, but there's a lot more good than bad. Even in the worst stories, the worst scenarios, there's a lot of good going on. And even in those bad neighborhoods that you mentioned, most of the people who live there, 95% of them are good, you know.
Yeah, they just want to get
by. They help each other out whenever they can.
Sure,
yeah.
I mean, whenever they have to or whenever they can.
But, I mean,
in some ways, the people in the suburbs or in the parts of the city don't. They don't even know who lives across the hall.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, the title of one of Studs' book, Hope Dies Last. And, you know, I'm sure you, Bob, you were out in every neighborhood in Chicago, and you see signs of hope. You must.
Yeah, you have to. If you don't, as a reporter, I think it's time to quit.
Get a job.
Yeah, definitely. Because you're not doing yourself any good, and you're not doing the readers any good either, I'm sure.
You're fooling yourself a lot of the time, and that's great.
How long have you been doing this, Bob? Pretend you're just meeting Tom Weinberg for the first time, and give him some background. Give the listeners some background too.
22 years.
What drew you to it in the first place?
Journalism reporting.
Yeah.
Oh, I've always, since I was a kid, in junior high school, I was writing little things for the little cheesy school paper, and then definitely
what school?
High school. Stevenson School in Morrow's Park, and then I went to high school out west in Naperville, and college, ever since I can remember.
Well, you two guys, and Tom's a native Chicagoan, there is not, in ways good and bad, a better news town than this town.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. And the point of you're saying that no matter where you go, you sense it, you taste it, you feel it, people tell you, and you get a sense of real life out there is not just bang, 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 or oh, my God, or whatever.
Yeah.
It's people, regular people in regular situations who, you know, are by and large decent and hardworking.
Well, yeah. You also have things like, you know, some of the best stuff on Media Brand. I don't know if you've seen any of the Jane Byrne getting elected stuff. That the stuff that you shot in her, I think it was the Ambassador East hotel
right,
room,
exactly.
At the moment where she is realizing that she is going to be the Democratic nominee, thereby becoming the next mayor, you must still, Tom, get a thrill watching that, do you?
It's terrific. I didn't shoot it. I wasn't in the room. It was my show. I put it on Image Union very soon after it was done. Lily Eilinger and Scott Jacobs and some put it, but it was remarkable because people wouldn't and couldn't behave that way anymore. You couldn't get in there. You couldn't talk to them.
See, that's something that's really changed in your life, the access, that how tightly controlled places and people have become. Bob, don't you think?
I don't totally agree.
Okay.
Because of social media, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, a lot of times you can cut out the PR flack or the publicist and go directly to that person, and which is nice for a reporter.
You mean how, though? Through social media? I mean, you make the...
Yeah, a lot of times through social media.
You can find out where someone's going to be.
Or you can direct message whoever it is.
And that works for you.
Yeah, it does, a lot of times.
For fact-gathering and getting accurate things.
An initial contact, if I want to contact so-and-so.
Right.
Maybe the person's like some kind of celebrity or whatever. It's easier to go straight to them than to mess around with some publicist whose only job is to
protect,
be a gatekeeper.
Yeah.
I hear you. But for me, I mean, I've been making videotapes with people and about people for 50 years. And what Rick said is exactly right, which is the access and the fear that they're going to be shown, which is, of course,
what happens on Facebook.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
See, they're fearing because they see other people get burned by shady report or people like TMZ or something.
It's the nature of the media. It's the nature of having a camera in your
pocket. Yeah, you're right. It's video. Yeah. Well, you look at the whole, you know.
I have the advantage there because I'm not a
You got a
TV
notebook.
Guy.
Yeah. Well, but eventually, I'm afraid everybody's going to have a camera.
Well, they do.
I mean, look at the Chris Cuomo. Look at the Fredo thing. You cannot escape. Everything seems to be, you know, the possibility of something becoming public is right there. Anybody has a phone.
Yeah.
And the context of it and the way it gets smeared, my pet one at the moment is Al Franken. His whole life was ruined by something that was stupid and probably... You know, you say everybody knows that's funny. Well, obviously, the people who wanted to get him
out
succeeded.
Used it in their fashion because you could read a piece in the New Yorker,
it's great.
Well-reported piece about within the last month about the whole that Al Franken thing on the airplane. It's pretty devastating, and
it
you
is.
Come away from that feeling really bad. for him.
But all of the Democrats who voted against him.
Many of whom are now saying, I'm sorry, I never should have done that.
Seven out of eight, eight out of nine are from the New Yorkers.
They were swept up in the whole thing.
Yeah.
You two guys have got to come back on here to talk about anything. No, this I'm really happy that you two met because it's a perspective, and you guys are guys I admire, and that is a crowd that is shrinking rapidly. And just to talk about the news and what is going on in this city, what do you both think of Lori Lightfoot?
Hopeful.
So far, yeah. Have to be.
Yeah.
I actually was hopeful that first week of Rahm Emanuel, too, though I did not vote for him. But look what happened
Not like this.
Yeah, it's too early.
He was coming from a whole different place.
Oh, yeah.
And he never got up on the first day and said, guess what, Alderman, you're losing your power.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, there's reason for optimism. Well, let's come back on in like 6 months. We'll figure out something. Are you covering anything? I mean, the stories. And again, please go to gatewayjr.org to read Bob's latest. What are you working on?
Well, I've been working on R. Kelly for the New York Times, and that's ongoing.
Yeah.
I've been working on Smollett. That's perhaps going to start again. We'll see. Covered that Christensen trial downstate.
Now you work like crazy. He's as prolific as anybody.
One after another, which is good. It's good.
Of course it's good. It probably doesn't pay you what you deserve. But and Ghosts in the Machine, the mediaburn.org co-production with some folks from Russia, will be at Uncommon Ground in Edgewater on Thursday night. That is $8. It will be free at Film Row Cinema at 1104 South Wabash on Saturday night at 6 o'clock. Tom Weinberg and Bob Chirito, it is an ongoing treat for me to know both of you guys.
Thanks, Rick.
Likewise.
My pleasure. Dan Long, you're the world's greatest engineer. Roe Coleman, you're the world's greatest producer.